This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Baxter with Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow for the Hoover Institution. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. And Richard is a classical liberal interpreting the law, in this case, a case before the Supreme Court, from the point of view of the classical liberal definition of harm, both dignitary harm and material harm. Did I say that correctly? And what are the distinctions that are important here, Richard?
Sure. Material harm means an economic outlay of some form or another. And what happened is the justices who decided in favor of the state said there was material harm. That material harm is basically $2 or $1, the cost it takes you to go from one website to another. In the cake case, you had to at least walk down the block. Here, what you have to do is to flip the switch to get to 1,000 other cases. I did my little search on the line, and I just put in gay bakers and so forth and wedding planners in Colorado and a bunch of pop, a huge number of websites, all of which are dedicated to serving gay customers. And most of them are, they say they're gay. We don't know whether they serve other people. It doesn't really matter. But what's really interesting is under the section, it's any communication that indicates a preference is illegal. So these sites ostensibly should be illegal. I would be horrified if anybody wanted to prosecute them on that. It's the double standard that's so painful. And so this person who has a substantive objection and a moral objection can't act upon it. And so therefore they're chasing after and they claim it's a monopoly. The classical liberal tradition says there is always a rule which says if you are a common carrier or a public utility, meaning that you are the only person who could supply at reasonable cost an essential service to a large community, you are under a duty to serve everybody in that community on fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory terms. So if you're an electric company and it turns out there are 1,000 people in your particular district, you cannot decide to simply do an auction and give all the power to 80 of those people and exclude 20 of them. What you have to do is you have to moderate your rates so that people do not have to pay monopoly charges, but you are allowed to charge enough and to allocate it fairly across your customers so that you can make a risk-adjusted competitive rate of return on your asset. And this model was developed a very long time ago by Sir Matthew Hale in the late 17th century. It was brought over into English law in a case called Allnut and Inglis in 1810. It gets carried over literally into American law in a case called Munn v. Illinois in 1876. And it has always been genuine monopoly gives you the non-discrimination duty. Nobody has ever thought that a single owner of a private home is somebody who characterizes as a public utility or as a common carrier. What happens is in all competitive markets, they're easy to figure out what to do if the goods are perfectly fungible, number five wheat, for example. But if you're in any other kind of competitive market, you're always trying to find a way to distinguish your property a little bit from somebody else's so as to give you a kind of a niche advantage, very small niche, but an important niche. This creates an immense amount of creativity because if you look around, you see that every house is not exactly the same. And it doesn't mean that they're not competitive with you. The broker takes you to 10 houses, all of which are different, and then you have to decide which of those 10 you wish to buy. That's a competitive market. And what they said in the Colorado case is, no, this is not competitive at all. It's unique and therefore monopolistic. And there's an absurd underlying notion that everybody in the market has to be serving everybody for the market to be efficient. And the net effect will be to drive this woman out of the web markets for a marriage site. So you're reducing the sources of some customers, the choices of some customers, and you're not increasing the choices of anybody else. So let me just sort of give a simple kind of numerical advantage. You start putting restraints on entry of the sorts that are here. They're going to be 100 units, and everybody's going to serve everybody. And so that's a wonderful choice. You get rid of those things, all of a sudden there are going to be 120 people in this market. And most of them will serve larger portions. So you may not find two or three people who won't serve you, but you'll find 118 or 117 people who will. So by clamping down on the size of the market, you're reducing consumer choice. And what happens is the opinion below is utterly oblivious of this stuff. I mean, when you read it, you want to pull your hair out. How can anybody make this kind of an argument to about monopoly. And so all of the antitrust scholars who know this field inside and out, they just look at this as a kind of disbelief that this is what we've been reduced to. And it's extremely important to understand that in cases like this, what you're doing is you're depriving somebody of his or her livelihood by putting these conditions on them. And the reason you're doing that is to make sure that there's a choice that somebody might want to have who won't use it. So the number of gay people who will come to this person to doing it in an open market will be very small because they want to make a gay wedding cake. And there are just a huge array of people out there who are prepared to serve them. I often put the challenge in the following way. Find me anybody who wishes to have a gay marriage in any community who cannot find adequate services for what it is they need. And this is a market which people actively recruit. And I think that's all to the good. Niche marketing is a sign of market strength, not a sign of market weaknesses. And so what you do is you see a court in the 10th Circuit rewriting the law of economics to support a result which I regard as essentially indefensible on moral ground. Coercion should never be exercised in ways that force people to choose between their livelihood and their beliefs. And that's exactly what they're doing. And they're doing it with a certain degree of glee, as far as I can tell. They can vindicate things.
You oblige me to learn United States versus Caroline Products, 1938, footnote 4, in which the court warned against, quote, prejudice against discrete and insular majorities. Close quote.
Minorities.
Now, that applies clearly to the Jehovah's Witness cases of 1943. And I'm presuming that still informs the Supreme Court as it makes decisions. Is that correct?
It certainly does. It's an argument for getting rid of the New Deal view that everything is up to the legislature. And Justice Stone, when he wrote that, had a case about filled milk, which was completely crazy, and he upheld the regulation, which was later struck down by a lower court. But he said, look, I can't go this far. I've got things that I really have to worry about. They're going to be religious cases, Jehovah's Witnesses, and they're going to be race cases. And I can't possibly use a theory of complete deference to the legislature. Well, the worm has turned. It turns out that these are fundamental Christians, very closely aligned to the Jehovah's Witnesses. They have very little dominant political power. At one time, it was certainly accurate to say about gray groups that they were prosecuted in the most insidious and ugly way. But that has completely changed. They're now a much more dominant group in the United States. We're in the middle of Pride Month. That's not a sign of weakness. That's a sign of strength. And I salute them for the successes that they've had in their own work. But deplore any efforts to try to say that you can't do business with anybody unless you're prepared to do business with me. If you're that strong, you should not have to exert that degree of coercive power. And so you can be strongly in favor of gay marriage as a consensual arrangement and deeply opposed to requiring Catholic churches to recognize those marriages.
We have 30 seconds, Richard. Is it your opinion that this present court will decide in favor of the website designer?
My guess is it will come out 6-3 in favor of the website designer. I think that's why they took this case. If there's a uniform line of cases against you, and all the cases have decided that way, Supreme Court's not going to take a case to be the 80th person to decide something one way. They're probably going to strike it down, and they're going to strike it down on the right
ground. Will they mention Justice Jackson in their decision, do you think?
Well, I certainly hope they do.
Robert Jackson, I've learned over the years, was a great political figure as well as a great justice on the Supreme Court. Robert Jackson. Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.